Butte, Montana was still dark when the cable crew arrived at the Granite Mountain shaft in the early morning hours of Friday, June 8, 1917. The men could see their breath as they worked in the cold open air beneath the headframe, a hulking 8-story steel structure that supported the massive weight of the hoists. The miners called it a gallows frame because it looked like a gigantic industrial version of the Old West's hangman's platform. Gallows frames dotted the sprawling hillside like Butte's version of trees. The official accident report does not list the names of the men on the crew that morning, but it is a good bet they were a motley mix. The no-smoking signs that hung around the mine shaft were printed in 16 languages. The report does provide the men's job titles, titles that reflect the task before them. 4 electricians, 3 ropemen, 2 shaftmen, and 1 hoistman. The worst hard rock mining disaster in American history began, ironically, as an effort to improve the safety of the Granite Mountain shaft. Granite Mountain, along with its sister shaft, the Speculator, were owned by the North Butte Mining Company. The two mines were rarities, productive Butte properties not owned by the omnipotent Anaconda Copper Mining Company. Anaconda did own all of the properties that surrounded the North Butte holdings. Anaconda, indeed, owned most of the city and a sizable chunk of the state. By the lax standards of the day, the North Butte Mining Company boasted a considerable reputation for safety. The cable crew's work on the morning of June 8th was part of an effort to install a sprinkler system up and down Granite Mountain's 3,700-foot shaft. The shaft was buttressed with chemically treated wooden timbers. In a fire, this highly flammable lining was the functional equivalent of a chimney made of wood. The new sprinkler system, though, was nearly complete. In a week or so, a shaft fire could be doused by simply turning a valve. One of the few tasks remaining was to relocate a large electrical transformer at the 2,600-foot station. Stations were cavernous openings at 100-foot intervals and were the junctions between the main shaft and the hundreds of tunnels that branched out from it. The 2,600 station, therefore, was 2,600 feet below the surface, or collar, of the shaft. The transformer at the 2600 station stood only 50 feet from the wood-timbered shaft. Worried that an electrical fire could easily spread, mine officials had decided to move the transformer to a safer location, deeper inside the workings of the mine and well away from the main shaft. The electrical cable that connected it to the surface, however, was too short. The job assigned to the crew was to lower a long cable that could reach the transformer's new location. In the era before plastic, electrical wire was commonly insulated with oil-soaked cloth, usually cambric or jute. In industrial settings such as a mine, the cloth was then sheathed in lead for protection. The new 1,200-foot electrical cable being lowered into Granite Mountain was a full 5 inches in diameter and weighed 5 pounds per foot, putting its total mass at a staggering 3 tons. The narrow 5-by-16-foot main shaft contained 3 hoists, side-by-side elevator cages that could be operated independently of one another. The cages were controlled by a hoistman on the surface. 2 of the hoists were dedicated to pulling up loads of copper ore from the depths of the mine. The other cage, called a chippy, was used to transport men and materials. The men in the shaft's various stations communicated with the hoistman through a complicated system of electric-powered bell signals. To lower the new cable into the Granite Mountain shaft, the crew planned to use the mechanical strength of the third hoist, the chippy. This necessitated the labor-intensive act of lashing the cable to the chippy's lowering rope, the rope on which the cage itself was pulled up and down. As the first 500 feet of cable was lowered, the crew tied the cable and the lowering rope together with hemp lashes at 10-foot intervals. After the first 500 feet, the crew tied lashes every 5 feet to compensate for the ever-increasing weight. By the time the entire cable was tied to the chippy's rope, nearly 200 lashes were in place. The crew had worked for 16 straight hours before the lower end of the cable finally came even with the 2600 station. Sometime before 8 p.m., the men were about ready to begin threading the cable toward the site for the new transformer, when they noticed a problem. The bottom 200 feet of cable appear to be coiled around the hoisting rope. Before snaking the cable into the 2600 station, the crew decided to make an attempt at straightening out the kinks. One of the men came up with the idea of removing some of the lower lashings. The hope was that the 3-ton cable, if freed from its lower bindings to the hoisting rope, would untwist itself, the way kinks unwind from a tangled telephone cord. The details of how the crew went about releasing the hemp ties are vague. It appears, however, that two or more of the men scaled the shaft walls and began cutting or untying the lashings. Adding to the precariousness of their task was the fact that the hoisting rope was smeared with lubricant to help it spool and unspool more easily. Whether or not the kinks began to unwind is unclear. What is clear is that as the men of the cable crew worked around 8 p.m. on Friday night, they noticed that the 3-ton cable suspended above them was slipping. Then, in a heart-sinking moment, they realized it was falling down.